Way News, I'm Michael Brown. Early on the September 11th anniversary of the terrorist attacks on the United States, a rocket exploded at the U.S. Embassy in Kabul. So far, there were no immediate reports of casualties. AP correspondent Mike Gracia picks up the story.
A rocket exploded at the U.S. Embassy in Afghanistan shortly after midnight in Kabul. No injuries were reported. There was no immediate comment from Afghan officials or the NATO mission, which is near the U.S. Embassy. The attack came early on the 18th anniversary of the 9/11 attack on the United States. It was the first attack since President Donald Trump called off surprise talks between the U.S. and Taliban at Camp David over the weekend. Trump cited the death of a U.S. service member in one of two car bomb attacks last week as the reason. I'm Mike Rossia.
The Trump administration is denouncing U.S. media reports that it evacuated a high-level CIA spy out of Moscow after he revealed that President Vladimir Putin ordered Russian meddling in the 2016 U.S. election in favor of Donald Trump. The reports say U.S. officials were worried the mole was about to be exposed because of the controversy in the U.S. surrounding the Russian interference. He was ordered out of Russia, refused to leave, but then decided to go because of the risk of exposure. Putin has consistently denied his government interfered in the 2016 U.S. election, and Trump has backed Putin's assertion even after U.S. intelligence said there is no doubt about Russian meddling. President Trump says his administration is discussing the possibility of granting residents from the hurricane-hit Bahamas temporary protective status, a short-term permission to reside here in the U.S. Bahamian authorities say the death toll from last week's Hurricane Dorian is at 50, but they expect that number to rise as more bodies are found. From here in Washington, this is VOA News. A U.N. spokesman says Secretary General Antonio Guterres is rejecting Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's promise to annex the heart of the West Bank if he wins re-election next week.
The Secretary General's position has always been clear and consistent. Unilateral actions are not helpful in the peace process.
A Palestinian Liberation Organization Executive Committee member tweeted that annexation would destroy any chance of reaching an Israeli-Palestinian peace accord. There was no immediate comment from the White House, but the Trump administration has been receptive to Israel's annexation of at least portions of the West Bank. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says the firing of the U.S. National Security Advisor will not mean a change in President Trump's foreign policy. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports on the shakeup.
The president announced the firing on Twitter, saying he told Bolton last night that his services were no longer needed. Trump tweeted that he disagreed strongly with many of Bolton's suggestions, adding, as did others in the administration. He says Bolton submitted his resignation this morning, and he'll be announcing a replacement next week. Bolton was Trump's third national security advisor after H.R. McMaster and Michael Flynn, who was fired for lying to the vice president about conversations with Russian government officials. Ben Thomas, Washington.
In the meantime, the White House says Charlie Kupperman is the acting national security advisor. At least 31 people are being mourned after they were killed Tuesday in a stampede during the observance of the Shiite Muslims' holy day in the Iraqi city of Karbala. The AP's Charles De La Desma reports.
Part of a walkway collapsed as tens of thousands of people celebrated Ashura, causing a deadly stampede on one of the most sacred religious days for the Shiite sect. The incident occurred towards the end of the procession, causing a panicked rush. Hundreds of thousands of people converge on the holy city, some 50 miles south of Baghdad, for the occasion every year. The somber day of Ashura commemorates the killing of the Prophet Muhammad's grandson, the Imam Hussein, by a rival Muslim faction in Karbala. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Japan's environment minister said tens of thousands of tons of contaminated water from the Fukushima nuclear plant might have been released into the Pacific Ocean. The water used to cool damaged fuel cores after the plant was damaged by the earthquake and tsunami back in 2011 is being stored in giant tanks at the site, but the storage space is running out. Japan's large fishing industry, as well as its neighbor South Korea, have strongly opposed the idea of dumping the contaminated water into the ocean. For more news, please join us, voanews.com or on the VOA mobile app. From here in Washington, I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm MT in Washington. Today is Wednesday, September 11th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. The body of former Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe is due back in Zimbabwe today, Wednesday.
The Minister of Information addressed the media on a Tuesday afternoon and said that they are expecting his body to arrive in Harare from Singapore on Wednesday in the afternoon.
That's reporter Blessing Zulu of US Zimbabwe service in Harare. Rwanda agrees to take in about 500 African migrants stranded in Libya. A new report says children imprisoned by Nigeria on terror charges face brutal conditions. Eritrea is one of top 10 countries where governments use digital censorship. And Cameroon President Paul Biya calls for national dialogue over the crisis in the country's English-speaking regions.
What Mr. Biya has put out today as a solution to this 4-year-old conflict is a non-starter.
Chris Anu is the spokesman for the Cameroon Separatist Movement, and ECOWAS parliamentarians are meeting this week in the Liberian capital, Monrovia. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The body of former Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe is expected back in Zimbabwe today, Wednesday, from Singapore, where he passed away last week at age 95. But in Zimbabwe, the controversy continued Tuesday between the government and Mr. Mugabe's family, whether Mr. Mugabe should be buried at the Hero's Shrine in Harare or in his home village of Kutama. Reporter Blessing Zulu of US Zimbabwe service, who is in Harare, says President Emmerson Mnangagwa and the ruling ZANU-PF want the country's founding president to be buried at the Hero's Shrine.
The Minister of Information addressed the media on a Tuesday afternoon and said that they are expecting his body to arrive in Harare from Singapore on Wednesday in the afternoon.
What's the latest now on the funeral arrangement? Because there's been some controversy in terms of where the former president would like to be buried. What can you tell us?
Of course, there are differences between the government and some family members. As happens with Zimbabwe's heroes, all national heroes are expected to be interred at the National Heroes Acre here in Harare. But sometimes the government allows families to bury their beloved ones wherever they want to be buried, although they are declared national heroes. What it means if you are declared a national hero is that the funeral will be state-assisted. So you can be declared a national hero and be buried in your own village. So this is what some family members of the late president are saying, that they want him to be buried besides his mother, Bona Mugabe. But there are also some family members who are pushing for him to be interred at the National Heroes Acre. And this is also the position of President Emmerson Mnangagwa. He is pushing for him to be buried at the National Shrine.
Reports coming to our studio late Tuesday quoted the nephew of the late President Leo Mugabe denying that there's been any feud between the family and the government. Does this indicate now that maybe there's been some understanding between the family and the government?
The problem is that even the family itself is divided. So there are some who are saying, let him be buried at the National Heroes Acre. And there are others who are also saying, we don't want him to be buried there.
Tell me, Blessing, what is the opposition in Zimbabwe, Movement for Democratic Change? What are they saying since his death?
The leader of the main opposition MDC party, Mr. Nelson Chamisa, addressed journalists in Harare on Tuesday, and he said ZANU-PF cannot claim Mr. Mugabe because Mugabe was no longer a member of ZANU-PF. He was expelled. So Mr. Chamisa is saying that this must be a national event, because remember, after he was ousted by President Emmerson Mnangagwa via a soft coup, if you may call it that way, he at one time even endorsed the opposition. This is why they are now claiming that he was one of their own.
What are the people of Zimbabwe, the ordinary people, what are they saying?
Talking to the ordinary people in Harare, what most of them are concerned about is the economy Of course, former President Mugabe, a very controversial figure. So it's kind of 50-50, because there are some who are saying that his rule was brutal, and others are saying that he empowered the nation by taking land, for example, from the white farmers and giving it to the black majority farmers. He did the same even with industries.
Blessing, thank you very much again. So nice to talk with you. And we look forward to speaking with you again the following day.
Thank you so much, Jen.
That's reporter Blessing Zulu of Viewers Zimbabwe Service speaking with us from Zimbabwe's capital, Harare. Cameroon President Paul Biya on Tuesday called for a national dialogue to address the crisis in the country's English-speaking regions, where separatists have declared a self-proclaimed independent Abazonia. Speaking in a nationally televised address, Mr. Biya said the talks to be led by the country's prime minister will start at the end of September. Chris Anu, the Secretary of State for Communication of the self-proclaimed Ambazonia Separatist Movement, says President Biya's national dialogue announcement is a non-starter.
What Mr. Biya has put out today as a solution to this 4-year-old conflict is a non-starter. Mr. Biya doesn't recognize that Southern Cameroonians have a problem in Cameroon and a problem of annexation and colonization. And so his idea of so-called national dialogue without recognizing what the problem is, again, is a non-starter.
Chris, this whole problem began with the protest of teachers and professors and students over the use of French in the region for legal purposes, for education. The president said that those legitimate grievances were taken over by, you quote, what he called the radical movement led by the diaspora.
If those were the real issues, the question would be, what did he do and what is he about to do to resolve and to fix those problems? Absolutely not. The teachers and the lawyers told him then, if you would not resolve this problem by going back to the federal system, Ambazonians would turn back to ask for their country back. And we are today asking for our country back because those problems were never addressed. And as per his speech yesterday, he is still not ready. And let me tell you what Mr. Biya is trying to avoid. All this so-called national dialogue is window dressing. Mr. Biya is trying to avoid the Swiss International Initiative, which all important international organizations and countries have endorsed. The Swedish initiative says negotiations that goes back to the root causes of the conflict.
I spent almost an hour Tuesday evening in the French division listening to the entire speech. I found very interesting that the president spoke only in French.
You are correct, sir. Mr. Biya has ruled Cameroon for going to 38 years, and he has never made a speech in the English language. Yet, he is the one to say, this is a bilingual country. This is one and indivisible country. And he cannot speak the language, the English language. So how can you protect us? He is not our president. Let me tell you, James, if we have any reason to acquire more arms, Mr. Biya has given us the incentive to do so. Going forward, every Ambazonian must have a gun, if possible a machine gun, in his or her home, because we have no choice. We must take back our country.
He said that there will be no pardon for those who killed, because to do so will be condoning impunity. I thought this to be a reference to your leaders who have been sentenced.
Well, Mr. Biya, if I understood him well, he is essentially holding our leaders who were abducted from Nigeria. He is essentially holding them as a bargain for his national dialogue plan.
Chris Anu is the Secretary of State for Communication of the self-proclaimed Ambazonia Separatist Movement of Cameroon. He was speaking with us from the U.S. city of Houston in Texas. Today is Wednesday, September 11th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is 14 minutes past the hour. Rwanda has agreed to take in about 500 African migrants stranded in Libya. The agreement signed Tuesday in Kigali comes after repeated allegations of dire conditions for migrants in Libya's detention centers, including routine abuse, lack of medical care, and insufficient food. Eugene Uwimana has more from Kigali.
The agreement was signed at the African Union headquarters in the Ethiopian capital of Addis Ababa, followed by a news conference in Kigali. The development follows a commitment by the Rwandan government in 2017 to host African refugees trapped in Libya as European nations stepped up migrant controls. On arrival, the first group of 500 refugees will be accommodated in Gashora Reception Center in eastern Rwanda. Ahmed Babafor, the country director of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, says this facility is equipped and ready to host the Africans.
The facilities are there, accommodation, wash, electricity, playing grounds, registration centers. So we are just renovating it and rehabilitating it to upgrade to the level of minimum standards to be able to receive these people.
After arriving in Kigali, the UNHCR says all stakeholders will look for durable solutions to make sure that those refugees will never return to detention in Libya.
And we'll be working closely with the government of Rwanda and the EU to find durable solutions that could include resettlement to a third country, that could include also repatriation to their country of origin, or local integration in this country.
According to the UNHCR, Rwanda is the second African country after Niger that has accepted to rescue these migrants. Rwandan President Paul Kagame took this decision after the American television CNN reported that migrants in Libya are being sold like slaves or tortured. In 2017, Rwanda accepted to receive 30,000 migrants from Libya. Critics said then that the country had been paid by the European Union to carry its burden. Rwanda dismisses these allegations, as Germaine Kamayiresi, the Minister of Emergency Management, explained during the post-agreement press conference in Kigali. Rwanda has not received any penny to accept to receive these refugees from Libya. Many Rwandans say they're happy with this move that their country has taken. However, economic experts say they doubt if this evacuation will respond to migrants' desire to travel to Europe. They also say Rwanda itself struggles with poverty. Ruzigama Santura works for the Rwanda Broadcasting Agency.
For those people who wanted to get rich quickly from the Western countries, are they going to get that thing that they wanted from this, the European countries? Here in Rwanda, it's difficult.
The UNHCR says it has evacuated more than 4,400 persons of concern out of Libya to other countries since 2017. The United Nations estimates that 4,700 persons of concern are held in dire conditions inside detention centers in Libya. Eugene Wimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
A new report by the independent media watchdog, the Committee to Protect Journalists, CPJ, lists Eritrea as one of the top 10 countries where governments use digital censorship and surveillance to stifle information and independent media. Viewer Salim Solomon spoke to Courtney Ratch, the advocacy director at CPJ, and she begins by explaining why Eritrea is first on the global list.
So Eritrea is really close to an information black hole. There's virtually no independent journalism there. The government uses a combination of repressive tactics, physical and digital repression and censorship to restrict basically any sort of independent information from getting in or out of the country. It restricts the movement of any journalists, and the only real ability to cover the country is by exiled media. And of course, there are journalists in prison who have been in for decades, and yet we have no information about them, and the government has failed to account for their whereabouts.
In response to the report that the Minister for Information of Eritrea said, 91% of households in Eritrea have satellite dishes, and that a survey at some point in 2017 said that these channels are deregulated. One of the methodologies that you list is access to alternative source of information. What would CPJ respond to this reaction from the government?
Well, first off, we know that there are, you know, severe restrictions on access to information, and there is no independent media reporting from the country. The satellite channels, we understand that there is censorship both via satellite jamming as well as online. And I don't think that, you know, simply having access to, for example, government-sponsored information counts as pluralistic media access. When you have, for example, 1% of the population connected to the internet, according to official UN figures, you know, that is, I think, indicative in part of the broader restrictions on access to information in the country. So Eritrea and North Korea share a lot of similarities in terms of essentially being information black holes and really restricting independent information to the extent that there's very minimal independent journalism in those countries. That said, North Korea does allow two small foreign bureaus by the Agence France-Presse and the Associated Press to operate in its territory. So it is slightly better. But again, the vast restrictions on internet and mobile access, the restrictions on any sort of independent media access, the reliance on, you know, pretty old school ways to get information, and of course the retaliation against anyone who tries to defy those restrictions means that it ranks right below Eritrea.
Oh, that was Courtney Raj, the advocacy director at CPJ. The Nigerian military has detained thousands of children in harsh and degrading conditions for suspected involvement with the armed Islamist group Boko Haram. Human Rights Watch says in a report released on Tuesday, it reports that children as young as 5 years old were held without charges for months or years in military detention facilities. Chika Udua reports from Enugu.
The report documents how Nigerian authorities are detaining children, usually with little or no evidence to prove they have links to Boko Haram terrorists. Human Rights Watch did not have direct access to military detention facilities in Nigeria, so this past June, the group interviewed 32 formerly detained children and youth in Maiduguri, the capital of Nigeria's Borno state and the city where Boko Haram got started in 2001. The children who spoke to the group said they were picked up by authorities and detained in the state's main military detention center, Giwa Barracks. A 2016 Amnesty International report described Giwa Barracks as a place of death. Scores of detainees have died there, possibly to dehydration and illness. 17-year-old Abdul described the room he was kept in. He says, "The room smelled awful. When we first arrived, there was no toilet in the room. We had to defecate in a bucket in front of everyone, as well as urinate standing in the room we slept in." Khadija, a soft-spoken and petite 14-year-old, was also detained. She says, "We really suffered in prison. It's a deep kind of suffering. The army didn't take care of us, and they kept beating me. Lice in our hair, lice on our body." She says all our clothes were full of lice. Children say they also saw male soldiers making sexual advances to some of the female detainees, even removing them from the cell for long periods of time. One girl told Human Rights Watch that girls in her cell became pregnant while they were imprisoned. In a statement Tuesday, a Nigerian military spokesman said the report is poorly researched and false. Colonel Onyema Nwachukwu said the armed forces of Nigeria do arrest children who are coerced into helping Boko Haram, either by setting off explosives or spying for the terrorist group. But he said the armed forces treat the children as victims of war and not as suspects. He said apprehended children are kept in secured places where they are adequately fed, profiled, and de-radicalized before their release. He added that children are not subject to arbitrary arrest, nor are they tortured in any facility. Chika Odua for VOA News, Enugu, Nigeria.
parliamentarians of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, are meeting this week in the Liberian capital, Monrovia, focusing on transhuman and community conflict. Moses Gaziowu spoke with Representative Edwin Snow, Vice Chair for Administration of the ECOWAS Parliament and head of the Liberian delegation to the ECOWAS Parliament.
We don't do country specifics when we do deliberation on parliamentary issues. In the Sahel, in northern Nigeria and other West African countries, you have problems with people moving one from one country or one village or one town to the other with their animals. And most times you get an animal that will either come here and eat their crops or go across the border and people get settled in those borders, and sometimes it turns into conflict. So what we want to do now is how can we address it? How can we resolve it? How can we say something about it? So maybe today is not Liberia, but it could come to Liberia. The Vice President will formally open the conference, and then of course on the 16th we're going to open our second extraordinary session that will be opened by the President.
How many delegates are we bringing? Are you bringing all of the members of the ECOWAS Parliament?
It's a full session, so everyone. The ECOWAS Parliament has a membership of 115, so all 115 are expected to arrive in Monrovia. Already we have about 90 persons have already arrived. Then we also have 30 of our staff. We have another 10 experts that will be coming. So 115 plus 30 plus 10. So you're already talking about a little over 150 persons that will be coming here. Then we also have another 5 from the ECOWAS Commission that will be coming. We also invited the former president of Niger, who was very instrumental in working with the authority of the head of state in the resolution or discussing transhuman issues in our region.
How prevalent is transhuman conflict and community conflict in the West African region?
Very. I can give you instances in Nigeria, for example. I still remember President Buhari's first term. There was a major issue that threatened his presidency just on transhuman and conflict in Nigeria. I can tell you similar situation in Burkina Faso, in Niger, in Mali, even in Ghana, in Guinea, in Cote d'Ivoire. Liberia may not have such a major problem, but it's a major problem in our region, and I'm happy that we'll be discussing it so that we all can find a way out or find a resolution.
Recently, there were issues confronting West Africans, specifically in South Africa. This has been a year-running thing, the xenophobia activities among South Africans towards their West African brothers. Is the ECOWAS Parliament also taking this as a serious case?
Definitely. That's a situation we're going to discuss. We have condemned it in our own weak way. We spoke against it. And the parliament, during our session, some of the parliamentarians, some of us, we're going to introduce this matter on the floor so that we can come up with a resolution to condemn it. Africa is one, and we cannot have our African brothers in South Africa ill-treating our West African brothers. We want to say to our brothers and sisters in South Africa that what we saw on the TV, what we saw on social media, if it's anything to go by, then we must condemn them, and we're shocked that of all countries, South Africa will do that to African brothers.
Representative Edwin Snow is Vice Chair for Administration of the ECOWAS Parliament. He spoke with reporter Moses Gaziewu in the Liberian capital, Monrovia. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The body of former Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe is expected back in the Zimbabwe today, Wednesday, from Singapore, where he passed away last week at age 95. But in Zimbabwe, the controversy continued Tuesday between the government and Mr. Mugabe's family whether Mr. Mugabe should be buried at the Hero's Shrine in Harare or in his home village of Kutama. President Emmerson Mnangagwa and the ruling ZANU-PF want the country's founding president to be buried at the Hero's Shrine. Cameroon President Paul Biya Tuesday called for a national dialogue to address the crisis in the country's English-speaking regions, where separatists have declared a self-proclaimed independent Ambazonia. Speaking in a nationally televised address, Mr. Biya said the talks to be held by the country's prime minister will start at the end of September. But the spokesman for the separatists said the call for a dialogue, is a non-starter. That is it for this Wednesday, September 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Carl Sterling. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Botte in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very, very productive week.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the biggest threat to President Yoweri Museveni's re-election in 2021 may be a 37-year-old musician. the future of Uganda on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.